Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Risk Map Podcast for the second half of September 2014. From New York, I'm Michael Moran, Managing Director for Global Risk Analysis at Control Risks, the global political integrity and security consultancy.
And in London, I'm Charles Hecker, Global Research Director for Global Risk Analysis. This week, we'll consider the upcoming summit of Asia's heavyweights, India and China, and ask how the current friction between Russia and the West over Ukraine will affect the annual opening of the UN General Assembly.
But first, Scotland. On 18 September, Scotland's voters will decide in a referendum whether they should begin the process of disuniting the United Kingdom. Polls indicate that independence for Scotland, once written off as a fringe issue, is a distinct possibility. The breaking of the link that has united Scotland with the rest of the UK since 1707 would have important implications for business and for other would-be independent nations like the Catalans and Basques. Joining me to discuss this is David Lee, our senior analyst for Europe. David, let's stay away from predictions. It's frankly too close to call right now. But assuming Scotland bolts the Union, what happens to the insurance, banking, manufacturing, retail, and other businesses who thought their presence in one part of the UK guaranteed access to all of its markets, not to mention that of the European Union?
Hi, Mike. Well, we saw two major financial services businesses based in Scotland announce that in the event of a yes vote, they would move their official domicile to London, probably, or certainly somewhere else in the remaining UK. And I think a lot of other similar businesses are probably likely to follow suit.
Let's play this out. A yes vote occurs. Give us the basics. What would happen to the currency? What would happen at the border? What would happen to NATO membership? Are these all issues that are still up in the air?
Every single one of those is still very much up in the air, yeah. The separatists in Scotland insist that they would continue to use the British pound sterling. But the British government has said, well, that's kind of up to us as well, and we don't want to enter into a currency union with you. EU membership, NATO membership, because it's a secession rather than a split of two equal states, EU membership and NATO membership would not be guaranteed, and Scotland would have to negotiate these very quickly if it wanted to get back in by the time it was independent. With NATO, that would probably be pretty easy because Scotland has all the conditions to be a member of NATO. With the EU, it's got those conditions too, but the EU is suffering from a bit of enlargement fatigue, having let three countries on its eastern borders in over the last 7-8 years, and back in 2004, another 10. So there is some suspicion that the EU might not be so keen on letting a new member in, particularly, as you mentioned earlier, Spain would not be that keen on letting Scotland in because it might encourage the Catalans.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Mike.
That's David Lee in London.
Mike, once upon a time, a summit of real import had to involve a Westerner. The classics like Churchill and Roosevelt, Nixon and Mao, Thatcher and Reagan, Reagan and Gorbachev, all had a certain unspoken link to the days when Europe ruled a good part of the world. But the 17 September visit of Xi Jinping, China's leader, to Delhi to meet with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi may be the shape of things to come. To discuss this crucial meeting, I'm joined by Jan Zalewski, our India analyst based in Singapore. Jan, we've had a change in leadership in India, and I'm wondering whether Modi's election is really going to impact Sino-Indian relations and what his election to the prime ministership means for the meetings next week.
Well, Chuck, yeah, I assume this will have an effect on bilateral relations, because since the first day that Modi assumed power, he has actively sought to strengthen India's position internationally. And significantly, he is focusing on regional relations, and on that front, he is notably pushier than his predecessor, Manmohan Singh. If a country like India changes its approach to foreign relations, obviously it's bound to attract attention. This could mean enormous trade and investment opportunities for some, but also geopolitical risks. So these aspects certainly loom large in India-China relations and will frame, to a certain extent, the nature of the exchanges next week.
Jan, speaking of geopolitical risks, Modi in his recent visit to Japan provoked some ire in China when he criticized the expansionist mindset of some countries, which came across as a veiled reference to China's growing assertiveness in the region. How much will geopolitics matter in next week's meetings, and how do you think the situation will develop?
Well, geopolitically, there are quite a few things that hang as a dark cloud over Sino-Indian relations. I mean, India has long been concerned about China's efforts to strengthen relations with neighboring countries, in particular, of course, Pakistan, but also Sri Lanka and the Maldives. Let's also not forget that India's territorial squabbles with China along their shared border remain a source of periodic tension, and there are frequent minor incidents along the border. The last one as recently as last month. So there's certainly mutual suspicion over each other's activities in the neighborhood, and both are likely to hedge their bets by continuing to seek partners and allies in the region. So geopolitical competition is alive and well in Sino-Indian relations, but that's only one side of the story. It's cushioned by a drive by both sides to cooperate more in terms of trade and investment. And I would argue that it is this side of the story that will dominate the talks next week. India desperately needs foreign investment in its infrastructure and manufacturing sectors. And China could be of tremendous help here. Xi will probably come with some good headline numbers for investment and cooperation in these and other sectors, both because Chinese companies see genuine opportunities and because China does not want to be overshadowed by Japan on the FDI front. On the trade front, China's actually been far more successful than Japan in growing its exports to India, and Modi will not want to see this in the spotlight because the trade deficit is a real headache for India.
Yeah, and finally, that sounds like a fairly packed agenda of topics to discuss. What are the concrete results, or do you expect any concrete results to come out of the talks?
Well, I would expect the meetings to roughly show the way in which both countries want bilateral relations to evolve going forward. India has a new government, so signals clearly are important. At this stage, I think the two sides will seek to maintain a status quo on the geopolitical front while actively pushing for trade and investment cooperation. China can be expected to pledge investments in industrial parks as well as in infrastructure and manufacturing projects. There's also a good possibility that China opens its borders for Indian goods a bit more. Beyond that, the main thing to look out for in the meetings really will be how well the two sides click. Perhaps there is not as much personal rapport between Modi and Xi as there is between him and Abe, but Modi is widely known to be an admirer of the Chinese growth model and visited China many times when he was the chief minister of Gujarat. The way in which Modi has been courting Xi to visit his home state of Gujarat to kick off the visit next week is indicative of real efforts on the part of India to woo China. To be sure, the geopolitical mistrust won't go away, and even if the two men get along well next week, we'll still see periodic nationalist chest beating over alleged expansionism and border issues and the like. But a good rapport could make a real difference on the trade and investment front. And all the fanfare about the Modi-Abe relationship shouldn't mislead people into thinking that India is going to risk alienating China with some new pivot to Japan.
India analyst Jan Zalewski in Singapore, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Chuck.
Well, nothing infuriates a New Yorker like the annual opening of the UN General Assembly, with its street-choking motorcades, overbooked restaurants, and sidewalk parades of security-cordoned world leaders and their satraps. But when the world body's annual gathering occurs this year, one important figure who will not be there is Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin says the Russian leader will skip the meeting this year, but the Kremlin can rest assured that Russia will not be absent from the assembly's debates.
Mike, this is precisely the kind of forum where we'll begin to see the true damage done to global governance by the Ukraine crisis. Can the shaky post-Cold War cooperation that has largely held since the Berlin Wall fell 25 years ago really survive? And I think, Mike, the broader question is the United Nations, with the small size of its Security Council and the reconfiguration of power in the world, really still fit for purpose in managing global conflicts?
Well, the veto that the US, Russia, France, Britain, and China wield has always been a problem. It effectively means that any issue that touches upon the interests of any of those five will be very difficult to reach consensus on. And consensus is the wrong word, really. You need unanimity, at least among those five, or at least to get one of them to abstain rather than oppose something. So with Russia and the U.S. now seemingly diametrically opposed, and the EU as well, on some issues in the world, and looking for ways to leverage each other, this could be a very interesting meeting. I mean, the Russians, of course, will be represented. They will speak their mind. But I can't imagine that they won't feel a bit more isolated than they did this time last year.
Mike, is this a sign of another part of Putin's withdrawal from Western institutions and this pivot away from the conventional way of conducting diplomacy and politics? And that really these sorts of organizations, they were never hugely popular in the Soviet period, and it looks like they're becoming increasingly unpopular now.
Well, I can imagine that in Washington, they're just hoping that the Russians storm out of the UN and suspend their membership the way they did just before the Korean War. I don't think Vladimir Putin's going to allow Russia to do that. But I do think that in an organization, the UN, which has been struggling to be effective anyway, these are precisely the kind of fissures that make it very ineffective. When the Security Council members are really, really at loggerheads, it makes it very difficult to get anything real done.
Are there any particular results that we should expect from this meeting? Is there anything spectacular going to happen?
And of course, the UN General Assembly opening is an annual event. It tends to be a place where we get a lot of rhetoric, some would even say diplomatic hot air. There have been some notable speeches in the past. Obviously, world leaders use this as an opportunity to push the agenda they have at the moment. I would imagine Obama will talk about ISIS. It'll be interesting to see how much he talks about Ukraine. I would think he will, because this is an opportunity to appeal to a larger forum on that topic. Global economy will certainly be an issue. And you'll also see regional leaders step up, as Hugo Chavez did very famously in 2003, and try to get noticed. So all of this can be great diplo-political theater. Nothing particularly comes of this in a resolution sense, but it's always interesting to see how the day's events and the issues of the moment are reflected back by this gathering of world leaders.
Mike, you're the New Yorker in this conversation, so my advice to you is leave the car at home and bring dinner to the office. Good luck making your way through the traffic.
I leave it home every day. All right, Chuck, that's it for this week. We hope you enjoyed this special edition of Risk Map Podcast, produced by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. It's available every other Friday on iTunes or via the Control Risks website, www.controlrisks.com.
Among the things you'll find there are our Africa team's look at risks to business emanating from the upcoming Nigeria elections. For my colleagues in 36 offices around the world, this is Chuck Hecker in London signing off.
And preparing for gridlock in New York, this is Michael Moran. Thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.